The first case for oral argument this morning is Jeanette Anson Appellant versus Starbright Inn Motel, defendant in Appley. For the appellant, we have Mr. Manuel DeCastro, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the Appley Starbright Inn, we have Mr. Daniel Fritz, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. DeCastro, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. On December 23rd, 2004, Ms. Anson was a guest, invitee at the Starbright Inn Motel here or in Yankton, South Dakota. She'd rented a room that evening to spend the night after having a disturbance at home, or I guess an altercation with her boyfriend. She went there to stay. Sometime during that night, she was awoken by some loud noise, some banging outside, and some flashing lights. She opened the door and looked outside and saw an ambulance, some police cars, and about that time she passed out. She was taken by ambulance to the hospital, where she awoke later and learned that she had suffered carbon monoxide poisoning at the motel that night. There were three other people at least staying at the motel that night, the Zarbucks and their daughter Peyton Gary. After Miss Anson was released from the hospital, she talked to the Zarbucks, who were family friends, and they had jointly kind of discussed hiring a lawyer in Sioux Falls to represent them by the name of Chad Swenson. Sometime in January of 2005, Miss Anson called attorney Swenson in Sioux Falls and made an appointment to talk to him about potentially filing a lawsuit against the Starbright Inn. In February of that year, Miss Anson went with the Zarbucks, I believe, or they all met there at some point, and talked to attorney Swenson about filing a lawsuit against the Starbright Inn Motel. Attorney Swenson told Miss Anson that he was familiar with these cases. He'd done these cases before. He had an expert in Denver who he usually used in these cases, and signed a contingency fee agreement with Miss Anson at that time. After that, Miss Anson sent attorney Swenson medical bills. I believe she faxed some in on March 14th of 2005 to his office, because he said to fax them in, get him the bills, he'd get them taken care of. She also sent him another letter sometime in the early part of March 2005, kind of giving him some names and some witnesses, some other people who might be there, and some people to contact. After she faxed the bills into him in March of 2005, she had some contact with his office, making some phone calls, leaving messages with his secretary, and she met with attorney Swenson sometime between March and May of 2005. She talked to him again. He said everything was progressing well, the case was going forward. He was talking to some attorneys on the other side, and they were kind of counteracting or having some discussions. It should also be noted, sometime during the time period from the January to the May 2005 time period, attorney Swenson sent Miss Anson a complaint that had her name on it, as well as the Zarbucks' name on it, sent her a copy of the complaint, and told her everything was going well. Miss Anson testified at the motion hearing that when she got a copy of that complaint, she believed that the case had been filed. She believed that based on his representations that he was talking to attorneys on the other side, that her case had been filed. She had no prior experience filing lawsuits, had never been in this position before, and relied on attorney Swenson's experience that he'd laid out, having done these cases, having worked for the Johnson Heideprim law firm before, and having experts in Denver. Miss Anson continued through May of 2005, through December of 2005, to call and leave messages with attorney Swenson's office, left messages with his secretary. She didn't actually speak to him during that time, but she did, I believe, in December of 2005, or thereabouts, have a meeting with Attorney Swenson in his office in Sioux Falls, where again, she was told that things were progressing well, things were going well, he was talking to lawyers on the other side, and everything was fine. I think he also indicated that he talked to the expert again. He hadn't decided to hire the expert because he didn't want to spend the money at that time, but he talked to the expert, and it was a good case, and things were progressing. From December of 2005 through the summer or so of 2006, Ms. Sanson continued to call Attorney Swenson's office, leave messages, talk to his secretary. She didn't have any personal phone contact with Attorney Swenson, but she did continue to make calls and kind of check up on her case. Some point during the summer of 2006, she also, I believe, went to his office, did find it locked at the time. It was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But at that time, she didn't think anything was amiss because she thought he might be in court or might be out of the office or something like that. So she continued to call Attorney Swenson during that time period. Through 2006 and 2007, Ms. Anson continued to call Attorney Swenson and continued to make contact with his office. I believe she did stop there one other time, but she did continue to make calls there. Now, sometime in the spring of 2007,
Let me ask you a question right there.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it, the record's a little bit confusing on this timeline. And do I understand that between fall of 2006 through fall of 2007, she continued to call but didn't get any responses at all? Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. She continued to make contact with his office. And it is somewhat confusing because she does suffer some memory loss from the carbon monoxide poisoning during that time period. But it is correct. She did continue to make contact and try to call his office. At some point, she found out his phone was off and his office was locked up.
But I guess what I'm getting at, making contact with an office implies that there was a two-way contact. Do I understand that during that year of fall of 2006 through fall of 2007, there was never a response? She never got a response that whole year.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I guess when I say make contact, she left messages at his office. At some point, he didn't have a secretary any longer. I think that was sometime around the summer of 2006. So from the fall of 2006 until the spring of 2007, she would have left messages. At some point, she did find out his answering machine was off and the doors were locked. But yes.
Let me ask you a question that I think goes to what most troubles me about the case, is that the other plaintiffs realized that Mr. Swenson was either disbarred, wasn't going to do anything, and they found another lawyer and got their case filed, served on time, and they got in. Your client left for Denver. She knew that she couldn't find Mr. Swenson. His office was closed. His phone was disconnected. Instead of going to a lawyer right away, she went to Denver for 3 months. And my question is this, you know, what good faith did she do after she knew almost to a certainty that Mr. Swenson just wasn't going to do the job, wasn't doing anything?
Well, after she knew that the phone was disconnected, I think the record shows that she got a phone book and called every Chad Swenson that was in the Sioux Falls area at that
time. Before she left for Denver?
That's my understanding, okay. Your Honor. And then she was transferred out of state for work for that 3 months for some new training on a different job. But she did attempt to make contact with his office, and once she found out the phone was disconnected, she did get the phone book and call every Chad Swenson in the area.
When she comes back from Denver, had the statute of limitations run?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, no.
Was it, what kind of time sequence then was there from when she gets back from Denver till the statute runs?
My understanding is she came back from Denver, as best as the record she remembers, probably in the early fall of 2007, September, October, somewhere in that neighborhood. And then she was, the record also shows that she was going through that year kind of a tumultuous breakup with an abusive ex-boyfriend, that she was kind of also had her mind set on that as well.
You mentioned something that really intrigued me, and I didn't see it in the briefs, and maybe I just missed it, but you mentioned that she was suffering some memory loss as a result of the carbon monoxide poisoning. So are we to infer from that that there was some mental impairment that she was having that may have affected her decision-making ability in terms of acting in good faith to try to make sure her case was progressing?
Your Honor, I don't know that I can actively say that there was a significant mental impairment to toll the statute for the potential 5 years it could be tolled for, but she did testify at the November motion hearing that she did suffer some memory loss, and that's why she was having trouble remembering some of the dates and the time frames as things progressed.
So that was presented to the trial judge?
It was presented at the motion hearing.
Did the trial judge make any finding on that issue?
No.
Mr. DeCastro, was there anything on her knowledge in the record of a statute of limitations objectively? Did she know? What I read, I couldn't find anything that said whether or not she was aware that there was a statute of limitations or what it was.
No, she indicated at the motion hearing, Your Honor, that at the time that Attorney Swenson had center the complaint with her name on it, she assumed that the case at that point was filed based on his representations. She had no prior legal training, no legal experience, and, you know, I guess she never contemplated a statute of limitations. She relied on Mr. Swenson.
Does that matter? Are you assumed to know even if she wasn't ever told?
Well, I think Attorney Swenson's conduct at the time that she got a copy of the complaint and then was told that he was actively talking with defense lawyers, I would assert that after that point, which was in early 2005, that she needn't worry about the statute of limitations because it certainly appeared to her, based on the complaint, based on the representations he was making, that this case, you know, had been filed and was progressing down the road.
In previous cases, we have acted where the other side has been somewhat culpable in their conduct, where an insurance adjuster would come in and say, don't worry about it, I'll take care of it for you, or some agent from the other side. Here, looking at what I've read so far, Starbright is absolutely blameless in this, as far as allowing this statute to run. Can you point to any misconduct that they engaged in that caused her to sit on her rights?
No, not at all. And I informed the trial judge of that. I was asked the same question, Your Honor, if I was alleging any misconduct on the part of Starbright, and absolutely not.
Is that then penalizing them for the misdeeds of somebody else?
Your Honor, I don't think it is. In this case, there's three other plaintiffs, the Zarbucks, and their daughter, Alicia Zarbuck, Peyton Geary, and Justin Zarbuck, who were staying at the motel the same night. The complaint that was filed on their behalf, I believe it was December 11th, 2007, the complaint is exactly the same as the complaint that would be filed or was filed with Ms. Anson, because they stayed there the same night. Certainly, they were on notice that she was injured. She was taken to the hospital that night. I don't think there's any prejudice to the defense at all in this case, Your Honor.
Isn't there prejudice between getting sued and not getting sued?
Well, certainly, but when we talk about the statute of limitations, we talk about, you know, being fair to other sides, making sure witnesses don't disappear, making sure that it's not overly burdensome on the courts, in factors that were shown in the Peterson case out of Huron in 2000. In this case, I don't think there's any of those factors apply here. Certainly, they were on notice at the time of the claim because, like I said, she was taken to the hospital that night. The facts are identical. There's no prejudice at all that I can see to the defendants in this case, Your Honor.
You say they were on notice of her claim. Other than the incident, was there any other notice that they would have had that she was actually going to file request for damages or file a lawsuit?
Prior to the statute of limitations
Correct.
Running? No. Aside from the facts I've indicated, shortly after the Zarbucks complaint was filed by Ms. Carper, a letter was sent to Ms. Anson in January of 2008 indicating that we represented the Zarbucks. She was potentially a witness we'd like to talk to. Essentially, who's your lawyer so we can get in contact with them? And then she called and indicated that her lawyer was Attorney Swenson, at which time I believe Attorney Carper called Attorney Fredson, indicated as soon as we knew that there was a potential claim, indicated there's another claim out there. Would you stipulate adding her? There was some conversations like that. There was some further conversations about trying to find Attorney Swenson's file, calling the clerk in Yankton to see if anything had been filed. And based on all the things that were done by Ms. Carper and myself, there was nothing that was filed. Attorney Swenson's file has never been found, and certainly he never sent her a letter that he'd been disbarred as well.
He was required to do that, though, wasn't he?
He was, Your Honor. Under SDCL 16-1978, the statute requires that when an attorney is suspended or disbarred, that he send a certified letter, return receipt, to any clients that he has to put them on notice. I believe he was disbarred, my memory serves me right, in June 14th of 2007. He was originally suspended February 22nd, 2007, but he never...
So if he had sent the letter, she would have had timely notice that she could have filed her lawsuit?
Right, she would have had a little over 6 months, Your Honor, to get the lawsuit filed timely.
Was there a supervising lawyer that was supposed to make sure that he followed through with those things?
I don't know, Your Honor. We contacted his office trying to get the file. I believe Ms. Carper talked to his secretary or someone overseeing the files, but nothing, to my knowledge, has ever been found. No file has ever been found at all.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate there were other guests that night at the motel that suffered the same fate other than the plaintiffs who timely filed their lawsuit?
No. I mean, they indicated there were some other people there. I don't know if they were injured or not. So
in other words, no other lawsuit or claim had been filed other than the defendants in, or the plaintiffs in this case?
Other than the other three plaintiffs, to my knowledge, there hasn't been.
So my understanding is that the trial court then really did make findings that the behavior of the attorney was egregious and did cause a lot of this delay. But the problem was is that your client didn't react soon enough, and mainly this three-month period. Was that your understanding of the trial court's ruling?
Yeah, yes. I mean, my understanding is he found his conduct was fraudulent, willful, and egregious, more than mere garden variety negligence. But the trial court found that when Ms. Anson couldn't get a hold of Mr. Swenson for quite some time, that she should have done some further things. We asserted, obviously, that she had made all these repeated phone calls, got the phone book, called every attorney in town, and then, through no fault of her own, was transferred out of state for some other training, and then, you know, had this other breakup. But for all intents and purposes, you know, in early 2005, Mr. Swenson indicated that this lawsuit had been filed and been progressing, and everything had been done and all the statutes had been met.
You know, Judge Rush relied on the Peterson case and pointed out that was a one-year delay, and it looks to me like he calculated it as a two-year delay in this case.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I guess what I would say is the Peterson case appears to me to be more of a garden variety negligence, where some of the attorneys in that case, on behalf of Ms. Peterson, filed a case in federal court. An answer was filed in federal court by the defendants alleging that diversity did not exist So they were on notice real early in that case. Plus, she had some attorneys that probably should have known the case shouldn't have been filed in federal court and should have been filed in state court, and then they attempted to file it afterwards, which I would assert is just garden variety negligence as opposed to the willful misrepresentations and willful conduct on the part of Mr. Swenson. In this case, I believe that Ms. Anson has met the burden of showing that equitable tolling should be considered, should be allowed in this case. I believe that she's met the factors that prejudice doesn't, you know, there's no prejudice to defendants. They were on notice as early on as we could have put them on notice, and they were also on notice when the incident happened. And I also think that based on Attorney Swenson's conduct, it was outrageous, and I'd ask the court to reverse the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. DeCastro. Mr. Fritz, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you indicated, my name is Dan Fritz. I represent the appellee in this case, the Starbright Inn Motel. The Starbright Inn is owned by Dennis and Terry Berkland of Yankton, South Dakota. It is my pleasure and honor to be before this court again. This appeal deals with the issue of the statute of limitations. This court has stated on several occasions that statutes of limitations are to be strictly construed, and equitable principles should be guardedly employed in an effort to subvert the effect of these statutes of limitations. It is undisputed that Ms. Anson, the appellant in this case, did not commence her cause of action within the statute of limitations period. In fact, the suit was not commenced until nearly 1 year after the running of the statute of limitations period. It is also undisputed in this case that there are no statutory tolling provisions that apply to toll the statute of limitations. And so we're left with whether the doctrine of equitable tolling applies to save or resurrect appellant's claim.
This case is so egregious, though, as far as the attorney's behavior. It seems to me that the percentage of fault, if there is any, for failing to get this filed in time, certainly doesn't fall on the plaintiff as much as it does on her attorney that she was depending on. Why shouldn't we give her a break in this case? We also have to worry about the profession and not have somebody injured because of an incompetent lawyer that we have later disbarred.
And I agree with you. I think we do have an obligation in that regard. I'm not sure the answer is to allow them to bring this lawsuit against my client, who is completely without fault. That is why we have, that is why there is available legal malpractice insurance. You know, these are things that I think can be addressed through mechanisms such as mandatory insurance, or at least providing notice to clients if there is no insurance. There are other mechanisms, I believe, to address that issue that you raised, Justice, that fit the problem better than allowing a party like this to bring a stale claim against my client, who is without fault.
So you're saying she can bring a malpractice suit against her lawyer?
Correct.
Is there insurance? You know that you bring it up?
I don't know that.
So in this particular case, we don't know if she has any remedy unless it's a remedy we recognize now.
That is true. I don't know that, whether there is insurance.
Oh, Mr. Fritz, you brought up the staleness of the claim, but in this case, although it is a different party, your client was aware of the claim. There were other claims that were pending. So does the staleness of the claim argument still apply? Well, it is stale in the sense that the legislature has determined that in cases of personal injury, a case that is not filed within 3 years of the accrual is stale. And the legislature did not say 3 years from the time that, it just said 3 years from the date of accrual. And so I think that is the test for whether the claim is stale. There were several people in this motel that night, in addition to the Czarbox and the and Ms. Hansen. My client didn't know, I mean, was very concerned, but did not know of the status of all of them beyond when they left the motel that night. And so really had no idea whether anyone had a claim or intended to pursue a claim against them until probably in 08 from Ms. Hansen, in Ms. Hansen's case, when I was contacted by after the statute of limitations period had run. So I would submit that it is stale pursuant to the statute of limitations and even under any standard.
Now, this complaint that she claimed, is that's in the record, that there was actually a complaint, or do we know that?
A complaint
that she got a copy of in the mail from her lawyer.
I believe that was made part of the record at the hearing, yes.
So there's no reason for her to believe that that complaint had not been filed, even though her attorney didn't respond to any of her phone calls for that period of time. She last contacted him, according to the findings here, in November, December of 2005. But when did she first know that that complaint had actually not been filed?
I guess I look at it as I don't think she ever reasonably should have believed that it was filed. She did receive a copy of a complaint. There's nothing in the record that indicates that Mr. Swenson told her that it was filed. There's her testimony that she thought that it had been filed, but never once does she testify, he told me that it was filed. That didn't happen. And there's nothing about the complaint that was sent to her that there was no certificate of service, for instance. There was nothing that indicated that it had been actually served. She just received a copy of a, I think it's even called a draft summons and complaint, or complaint, not even a summons. And so I would submit that I don't think there's a reasonable basis for her to believe that it had been filed, even though she may subjectively have testified that she believes it had been filed. I'm not sure what that's based on. So I believe that the trial court correctly found that equitable tolling does not apply to this case because the appellant did not take reasonable steps to protect her own rights. And I would submit that the trial court made a factual finding in that regard. It took it took testimony from appellant. It received documents submitted by appellant, and therefore I would submit that this court should review that decision by the trial court under a clearly erroneous standard.
Let me ask you about that.
Okay.
You know, there really isn't any dispute of fact. There's no dispute of historical fact about anything that happened. Isn't it just a question of how we should apply the existing facts to the law to decide whether this was reasonable? And if so, that really implicates more of a de novo standard review than a factual, clearly erroneous standard, doesn't it? Let me put it this way. I didn't see where this wasn't the kind of case where somebody said, I said this, no, this is what happened. It wasn't that kind of a factual dispute.
I agree. I guess I would say that I don't know that there needs to be a dispute for it to be a factual determination. For instance, in a summary judgment setting, if the court takes evidence and all of the evidence runs in favor of summary judgment, I still think that's a factual finding. It's based on the facts. Just the fact that it's undisputed, I don't think changes the nature of it being a factual dispute. And so I would agree with you that we didn't submit any contrary evidence. However, her testimony, the appellant's testimony, and the exhibits that she offered established, in my mind and in the court's mind, that she had not taken reasonable steps to protect her own rights. And so I would submit that it is a factual finding. It was based upon facts. There was a need to inquire into the facts in order to get to where the trial court got to. And Judge Rush observed appellant testifying, was able to weigh her credibility and whatnot. And so I would submit that it was a factual finding. In any event, the facts, as stated by Judge Rush in his opinion as to this issue of whether the appellant acted reasonably, are well stated, and I think the court has addressed them with Mr. DeCastro quite well. What is most telling to me is she hired Mr. Swenson in February 2005. She sent a letter to Mr. Swenson a little over a month later, in part referencing the fact that he had not been returning her phone calls. Within a month, almost a month of her hiring him, the issue is already an issue of his lack of diligence. And then we skip forward to from the end of 2005 until the limitations period ran in the end of 2007. She not once had any contact with Mr. Swenson, despite making 1 to 2 phone calls every month to his office, leaving messages for him to call her back. Not once did he call her back. In addition, during that 2-year time period, she went to his office and found it locked in the middle of the afternoon. During that 2-year time period, she called his office finally in September 2007 and got a message that his line had been disconnected. This element, and the fact that's not set out in Judge Rush's decision, is that this lawsuit wasn't eventually filed until December 2008. She received a letter from Ms. Carper telling her that Mr. Swenson had been disbarred in January 2008.
But didn't she make a timely motion to amend the complaint of the Czarbucks in January 2008, less about a month after the statute runs?
Yeah. I'm not sure a motion to amend was necessary. She's a party that was not a party to the original action.
But, I mean, she didn't sit there for a whole year after the statute ran.
That is true.
Nothing.
That is true. That is true, Your Honor. But in any event, we've got, putting aside that fact, you've got a 2-year period of time where she is doing nothing but calling and leaving messages and getting no response. She didn't call the State Bar Association to check on the status of Mr. Swenson. She did not call the court to check on the status of her claim. She did not call another attorney to see if this was normal behavior or if she should be doing something different. This element of, or this requirement of reasonable conduct by the party is an important element, because if you don't enforce that element, we could have tolling that is indefinite. If we're going to allow tolling in cases of attorney error, you have to correspondingly enforce this element of reasonable conduct by the party.
Haven't we already said in the Peterson case that garden variety negligence isn't a basis for tolling?
I guess I didn't read it that way, but yes, the Peterson case does say that imprudent legal practice is not the basis for tolling. And that gets to, I guess, the second point that I want to raise, but for now I wanted to say that I believe that Judge Rush's decision as to the reasonableness of the appellant's conduct is not only not clearly erroneous, but it was correct and well supported by the facts. To your point,
when reasonableness, let me just interrupt you before we get off reasonableness, that the reasonableness also is somewhat, I mean, you look at it as what would a reasonable person do under these circumstances. There were other plaintiffs who evidently had similar experiences here. When did they figure it out?
The Zarbachs are the only folks to have commenced suit. They got the suit filed within the limitations period.
When did they? I assume they had the same lack of response from the lawyer.
That is true.
Is there anything in the record that indicates when it dawned on them that we've got problems here?
All I know is that they filed suit, I believe, in the fall of 07. I haven't heard from the Zarbachs as
so we don't know when they actually contacted another lawyer.
I don't know that. But to your point, Justice Gilbertson, putting aside whether the elements of equitable tolling apply in this specific case, I believe this court has indicated that its reluctance to apply equitable tolling generally to cases of attorney error or attorney misconduct, and that is in the Peterson v. Holm case. And I'm sure the court is familiar with the facts of that case, but in short summary, it was a case in which the plaintiff brought suit against a group of doctors for medical malpractice, actually it was a wrongful death claim, brought the case in federal court. The plaintiff's attorneys brought the case in federal court when, in fact, there was no diversity of citizenship. Some period of time later, defense counsel moved to dismiss, and that motion was granted by the federal court based upon the lack of jurisdiction, as there was no diversity of citizenship. Plaintiff's counsel then turned around and tried to file the case in state court after the running of the limitations period. Defense counsel moved to dismiss, saying the claim was barred. Plaintiff's counsel responded, in part arguing that equitable tolling should apply. The court pointed out, as I indicated earlier, that that statute of limitations are to be strictly construed and that equitable principles should not or should be used sparingly in this realm. And then it said, quoted the North Dakota Supreme Court with approval in saying that imprudent legal practice is not reasonable conduct and should not invoke the doctrine of equitable tolling. And so I would submit that the legislature has never seen fit to enact any type of tolling provision such as urged by appellant in this case. This court has indicated or suggested in the Peterson v. Holm case that it would not adopt such a tolling provision. And there are sound public policy reasons for not extending equitable tolling in this realm. If we were to extend equitable tolling to cases in which an attorney misses the statute of limitations, we fundamentally changed the operation of the statute of limitations. Currently, a party is duty-bound to commence a cause of action within the limitations period. If we were to adopt this principle, no longer would a party have to commence the cause of action within the limitations period. You'd simply have to hire a lawyer within the limitations period.
You know, but isn't that really a kind of a red herring? Because factually, this case is so much different. I mean, we have just out-and-out fraud here, really. We have a disbarred lawyer. We have what appears to be fraud. And it's not anything close to what was considered in Peterson. So I don't see how we'd be setting that precedent in this case.
I certainly am not going to defend Mr. Swenson's conduct generally. I mean, but in the end, in this case, what he did was he missed the statute of limitations. I mean, there's no record that he
misled her, that he lied to her. He just didn't return.
I thought he was telling her her case was progressing fine.
That's true.
That's certainly a lie.
As of the last time he spoke with her in the end of 05, that could have been true. I mean, it's progressing. I'm not sure what that means. He certainly didn't say, I filed the complaint. Now, had he said that in the end of 07, maybe that'd be different. But in the end of 05, it very well could have been progressing. I'm not sure. But, again, I don't see this as being one of these cases of egregious. Again, his conduct generally, I think, not returning all these phone calls and things is certainly not conduct that we would advise or look positively upon. But in the end, I think the conduct that is the subject of this appeal is his failure to file this claim.
And judge disagreed with you on that point, though, didn't he? The trial judge found that there was this is beyond the garden variety lack of diligence.
He did. That's true. He did. That is true.
Well, he defied an order of this court to notify clients he'd been disbarred. There's a statutory obligation which he defied, and I assume if you dig in the code, it's probably got some kind of criminal culpability for it. So that isn't this, and if he had done either one of those things, she'd have known well in advance of the statute that he'd been disbarred. He didn't do any of that. So isn't that a basis for finding that this is gross negligence, fraud, whatever have you? That's certainly not garden variety negligence.
And that raises a point of, I think the initial issue is this court going to ever expand equitable tolling to the situation of attorney misconduct? And if they are, what standard is going to be set? Is it gross negligence? Is it egregious conduct? Is it fraud? That has never been, because this court has never recognized tolling in these situations, it's never been addressed. And so we're dealing with a standard that that Judge Rush, I think, assumed might be adopted, but yet this court has never adopted. And so it's a little tough to address without knowing exactly what the standard might be.
Thank you, Mr. Fritz. Your time has expired. Mr. DeCastro, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Just to touch on some of the things Mr. Fritz said, Justice Meyer-Henry, the complaint is in the record. It was submitted as evidence in the November motion hearing.
Does it say draft?
It does not, Your Honor. I have a copy of that. I think a copy was also provided within the briefs. It does not. In fact, it has a demand for jury trial on it. It has the Swenson Law Firm attorney for plaintiffs, and it's an 18-paragraph complaint with count one for negligence and count two for punitive damages with all of that. So that is in the record. That was sent to her. It's not a draft complaint. I would submit that the proper standard of review in this case would be a de novo standard. I think in the Dakota Truck Underwriters case, this court indicated that the application of a statute of limitations is a question of law to be reviewed de novo. And also, the court also has noted when relevant facts are undisputed, and something's denied as a matter of law, it's a de novo review. I would also assert that this motion to dismiss that was granted would also be a judgment on the pleadings, which again would be application of law, which again would require a de novo review. I would certainly assert that this is much more than garden variety negligence. This is willful, wanton, fraudulent conduct on the part of an attorney, and certainly I think it's an exceptional case. We're not standing before this court asking this court to allow equitable tolling in every case where an attorney misses a statute of limitations.
All right, granting you that, how does that translate to allowing the suit to go ahead against the appellee in this case, who had nothing to do with Mr. Swenson?
Well, in this case, you know, we have to show timely notice, which we've shown. We have to show no prejudice, which we've shown. This case, I think, can be viewed differently than, let's, for instance, say Ms. Anson was the only person at the motel that night and the only one injured, and sometime after the statute of limitations passes, she finds out her lawyer is disbarred, would be distinguishable from that case where we already have three other plaintiffs who filed their lawsuit December 11th, which was about 2 weeks before the statute of limitations expired, which puts them on notice, as opposed to just somewhere out of the blue, a plaintiff popping up or something like that. Certainly they were on notice, and I think Judge Rush found that as well.
Normally it's a malpractice case, though, if your lawyer misses a statute of limitations. What's different about this?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, we have the conduct on the part of Mr. Swenson that's so egregious. I'll tell the court there is no insurance there. There's nothing left. As the court might expect, once Mr. Swenson was disbarred and didn't notify any of his clients, people realized it at some point. I think it was published in the paper. You know, all the malpractice insurance that was there, whatever the limits were, is gone. So if this court does not allow Ms. Anson to proceed in this case, there's nothing for her. There's nothing left.
Is the extent of her injury a factor that we should consider here, saying that if there's a scale where somebody's seriously injured, that would be a factor, and maybe not so seriously injured, that would be less of a consideration?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I would think that we need to look at the conduct of the attorney to begin with. Mr. Fritz is talking about letting this occur in every case where an attorney misses a statute of limitations. That's not the case here. I don't think we need to look at her injuries in this case. I think we look at the timely notice that was laid out in the Dakota Underwriters case, the prejudice to the defendant, which there is none, and then the reasonableness and good faith part of the plaintiff. And in this case, Ms. Anson acted reasonable. There's no allegation that she acted in bad faith in any manner. She acted reasonable in good faith, relied on an attorney who held himself out to be a very experienced, competent attorney, and relied on him and the complaint and everything else that he told her to get this done. I don't think we want to extend this. I agree with Mr. Fritz. We don't want to extend this to every case an attorney misses a statute. But this is an exceptional case with extraordinary circumstances, and I think that equity would require that this statute be told in this instance.
It seemed to influence the trial court judge, the fact that she still sat on her claim even when she knew or had reason to believe her attorney was not pursuing her case for her. She left town for 3 months. That seemed to weigh heavily on the trial court's decision.
I would agree in
and,
reading
and
the
And why opinion. Should we reverse that?
Well, I think the facts of what was going on in her life, you know, she was transferred out of state for work. She had a complaint that's not called a draft complaint. She was told that he was talking to lawyers on the other side, negotiating it. As we know, lawyers don't get involved on the other side until cases are filed. Usually it would be an adjuster. He'd been talking to experts. She, for all intents and purposes, fully believed that this complaint had been filed and this case was progressing down the right path. That's what he told her consistently.
But under any standard or any way of looking at this, in August of 2007, before the statute had run, she clearly, at this point, is on full knowledge that she's got a major problem because she's calling every Chad Swenson in the phone book. So, I mean, from that point on, before the statute ran, isn't she on some kind of notice there that she's got to do something right now? I mean, we've got 2 years of no contact, and then it looks to me like she finally figures it out in August of 2007.
Well, from the record, she doesn't know that a complaint or the case hasn't been filed until she's contacted in January of 2008. She has no idea that her claim had not been filed until that contact. She did call every Chad Swenson in the book, and I think she did testify that she thought maybe he'd moved offices or changed offices or something like that. And, you know, at some point she was transferred out of state. But I would assert that she fully thought that this claim had been filed and had no idea it hadn't been filed until she was contacted in January of 2008. And I don't think a reasonable person in her case would have known otherwise. She never testified, or there's no evidence in the record that she knew what the statute of limitations was or that she knew anything about legal cases. She hired an experienced attorney and relied on him, which I think is reasonable. Certainly, I think I would go back to what Mr. Fritz said when he indicated that the motel wouldn't have known whether people were injured. Well, Ms. Hansen was the only one that was taken out of there by ambulance.
Mr. DeCastro, when we decide these kinds of cases, we not only have to look at the effect of this decision on the parties, but also long-term on everybody in South Dakota. Traditionally, this court has been vigorous in enforcing statutes of limitations. They are not disfavored. Are we reversing that and opening the floodgates if we go with your argument here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that this case is an exceptional case. This case is a case that requires the court. The court has already, in the Peterson case, acknowledged equitable tolling. And I think in this case, when we look at the facts of this case, Your Honor, when we look at the whole totality of it, this is a case that is so outrageous, so egregious, that I think equity would require that the court in this case, I'm not saying every case, I think the court could look at it on a case-by-case basis. If the attorney conduct certainly is garden variety negligence, as the Peterson case is, the court said equitable tolling did not apply to protect that plaintiff. But in this case, the conduct is so outrageous and so egregious that I don't think we open the floodgates to every claim or every misstatute of limitations. As the court knows, very rarely in South Dakota, we have a very good bar with very few people getting disbarred. Most of the time, they follow the court's order and the statutes and give notice. In this case, it wasn't. It's extraordinary, and I would ask the court respectfully to reverse the trial court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. DeCastro. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.